continuation of what I've told you about earlier. Okay, so this is joint work with my master's student, Javier Peraza, and my colleague, Miguel Paternain. Okay. So let me get right to it. What are, for those of you who haven't seen these talks, what do I mean by null canonical gravity in terms of free initial data? What I mean is that it's null, it's canonical gravity in terms of initial data set on a double, on a pair of null hypersurfaces intersect on a two-dimensional disk. So in space, in a 2 plus 1 dimensional space-time, that initial data surface forms a sort of an open book. Here you can see it without embedding in a 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time. And so already, so these are, these hypersurfaces then consist of two null branches which are swept out by null geodesics emerging normally from this two-dimensional disk in space-time, S0. Okay, and they're cut off before they form caustics. Good. Okay, so already in the 1960s, people found Roger Penrose, Ray Sachs, George Daku, found initial data on these hypersurfaces, which are free in the sense they have no constraints. So if you build up your classical canonical theory in terms of these data, this offers a possible avenue to quantization without having to deal with constraints. Okay. So I want to present the data I would use, but for that I need some coordinates.
I'm sure you're going to go there. So when you say that you have to quantify, there's no constraints on the null sheets, but there is like Gauss constraints.
No constraints at all. No constraints.
Like the twist and the two expansions have to satisfy some equations.
No. It's true that
Gauss could add the enriching and the embedding of the 2D sphere.
But there.
I thought there were three elliptic equations on the sphere that you have to.
You can really reduce it to just totally free data. There are no constraints at all. Okay. It's true that in my papers on the Poisson structure, I actually reintroduce one constraint because it lets you treat the two branches more separately. But you can get rid of that constraint very easily if you want. So basically there are no constraints. So to explain the initial data, I need some coordinates. The coordinates are very simple. You pick any coordinates you like on S0, and then you hold them constant along the generator. So each pair of these coordinates, theta 1 and theta 2, identify a generator. And now to identify points on each branch, you need a parameter along the generators. And I will use so-called luminosity distance, or maybe it should be called the area distance. It's a parameter V chosen so that the cross-sectional area of a bundle of neighboring generators is proportional to V squared. So if you're in a light cone in flat space, this would be the radius from the center, spatial radius. So this works in generic double null sheets in generic spacetimes. Generic double null sheets in any spacetime. Okay, so here are the data. There are two types. There's the bulk data, which is specified on the entire null sheets, on the two null sheets, and then there's the data that's specified on the intersection two surface. Okay? So let me first explain the bulk data. It's just one item, the so-called conformal two metric. Okay? Because the tangent to the generators, which is you can write as d by dv, okay, because this is a null vector that's also normal to the null hypersurface, there is no dv term in the line element. So you end up with effectively a two-dimensional line element on, so a degenerate metric on this three-dimensional hypersurface. This really gives you the distance between points on any space-like cross-section, or any, when it is actually space-like, but any cross-section transverse to the generators through one of these null hypersurfaces. Now, with this two-dimensional metric in hand, you can define an area density. It's just the square root of the determinant of this h on any such two-dimensional cross-section. And you can define EAB as HAB divided by this area density. This makes E, which is the conformal two metric, have determinant 1. So you're left with a determinant 1 symmetric real matrix. So that has 2 real degrees of freedom. You can package that into a single complex degree of freedom, which is will briefly be useful to us, useful to state a result. That's simply, you do it this way. You take your coordinates on S0, theta 1 and theta 2, you form a complex coordinate. And then you can repeat the old trick of expressing the Euclidean metric in terms of a complex coordinate as d by the z bar. But now you don't have a Euclidean metric. You have an arbitrary metric. So there are some dz, dz terms, and some dz bar terms as well. But you can always rewrite the line element in terms of dz and dz bar. And you have these coefficients mu and mu bar there. You divide this line element by rho. You see that all the information in E is in mu and its complex conjugate mu bar. You can also represent the complex metric, but then mu bar is independent of mu. Okay.
These are functions of V.
These are all functions of V and of the theta, theta 1 and theta 2. And these are given as initial data as of those function of those three variables. And now we have, we turn to the surface data, which are given just as functions of two variables, theta 1 and theta 2. These on, or if you will, on the intersection two surface. The first one is the three items. The first one is the area density on the intersection two surface, which we call rho zero. Then there's lambda, which is minus the logarithm of the absolute value of the inner product in spacetime of the normal of the tangent vectors of the generators that come out of S zero at the point in question of the two generators that emerge from that point. Na here is d by dva. So it's the tangent along the generator of the branch Na, which can be left or right. Okay? And finally, there's a two-form, a twist, which is given by this expression. I won't go into it because it's going to disappear in a moment. Right, but those are the three geometric data. Okay, so you can calculate the Poisson brackets of these data. And I did that some years ago. And the result is not so bad. All the non-zero brackets are here. They all fit on one transparency. But on the other hand, from the point of view of someone who wants to quantize this, they're not so good either. You don't really have any idea of where to begin. So what you really need is some pattern, some structure in all this. Otherwise, it's just hopeless. Well, so that's what this talk is about, finding some pattern, some structure in all this. And my earlier talks, you might remember if you saw them, also dealt with that. Well, so the first thing you notice, if you look at it a bit, is that only data that lives on the same generator, only data living on the same generator have non-zero brackets among themselves. There are delta functions, delta distributions, that set the Poisson bracket between data on different generators to zero. And this is as it should be, because any points that are not on the same generator on such a hypersurface are space-like separated. Right? They're not causally connected. Well, you have to worry a bit about how it's embedded. Okay. So, morally, this complicated Poisson algebra decomposes into a sum of one-generator Poisson algebras. Of course, it doesn't literally do that, because delta at zero doesn't have any meaning. But if you were, for instance, to discretize this system, for instance, you wanted to make a numerical simulation, then you would replace these deltas by Kronecker deltas, the Dirac deltas by Kronecker deltas, with some normalizing factor. And then you literally would have a sum of algebras of data on one generator. So let's call a one generator algebra the algebra you get by removing the deltas, restricting mu and mu bar to be functions on a single line, lambda and rho zero and tau also, it's not here, these two to single numbers, tau just to pair of numbers. Okay, and here is the one generator algebra for mu mu bar lambda rho zero on the left branch minus S zero. Well, of course, lambda and rho zero are at S zero, but mu and mu bar we're only considering mu and mu bar that live on the left branch minus S zero. So it still looks rather complicated. Okay. There are four brackets given here. All the others are zero. H, if you haven't seen this before, is a step function.
Okay. A question about this?
Sure.
So you've been saying that it's only not vanishing if it's on the same generator.
Exactly.
If I had a left going and a right going generator that come out of the same point of S0, is there any reason that has to vanish?
Yeah, they're still space-like separated.
No matter where they are on the generator?
Well, okay, so then you get into how this surface is embedded in space-time. But you can, so this is also a whole issue of how can you be sure that you don't have intersections of the branches. And you can't be sure. But this actually happens even in the space-like initial value problem. You can easily cook up a space-like hypersurface with a boundary that enters its own domain of dependence. And the way it's dealt with there and here is you find that there is a space-time which a sort of a covering space-time in which the surface can be embedded with all its data. It's an isometric space-time in which the generators the two branches don't cross. And another feature is that really all points that are not on the same generator are space-like related. The way you construct the space-time is you take the normal bundle of S0, and you pull back the metric using the exponential map, and then you construct this.
Is there a reason why mu bar is not symmetric? Lambda symmetric?
Yes, yes, this is a long story. This is absolutely, yes, it's a long story. It's initially a somewhat alarming property because it means that it doesn't strictly preserve the bracket doesn't preserve the reality of the metric. But it also turns out that although these are initial data, and normally you suppose that initial data have to match onto the development, right? The Cauchy development, really the field equations don't quite require that in the case of null hypersurfaces. And there are shockwave modes that just travel along, they just skim along these hypersurfaces, and they don't enter into the domain of dependence. The imaginary modes that are generated by this in the metric are precisely such shock waves. So they don't enter into the domain of dependence. So you just barely get out of having a problem with the reality of the metric. But you do get out of it. Okay. So I'd like to... Okay, so we want to find... we want to find some patterns to make sense of this. Okay, so there's one nice thing. This one generator algebra has a significance. It is the Poisson algebra of cylindrically symmetric gravity on a double null sheet, one of these initial data surfaces, adapted to the cylindrical symmetry. And you have to set G prime, which is the sort of the Newton's constant multiplied by normalization factor equal to Newton's constant divided by the theta coordinate area of S0. That's a detail. Okay. Okay, so cylindrically symmetrical gravity, at least when the twist is set to zero, is an integrable system. Okay, if the twist is not set to zero, as far as I know, nobody knows if it's integrable or not. Maybe somebody does. But Hermann Nicolai told me that he tried once to find a lax connection with twist not zero, and he didn't succeed, but maybe it could be done. Or maybe it's impossible. Okay. And using this integrable structures, of integrable systems, Korotkin and Sumplevin in 98 were able to quantize it on algebraic level in the asymptotically flat case. With algebraic level, I mean that they found an exact consistent algebra of of operators, but they didn't find, or they proposed a unitary representation, but they weren't able to show that it was unitary. So there is a quantization at the algebraic level, but there isn't an appropriate representation in Hilbert space. Okay, so this is very promising. This algebra, which contains a lot of the ugliness of our initial algebra, actually it was possible to quantize it. Or actually it was possible to quantize part of the data, the main data, the bulk data. Okay, so we want to take advantage of these results and see if we can understand our algebra and then go on and add the remaining data and ultimately pull everything back to the non-symmetric general four-dimensional case. That's the program. But okay, so Korotkin and Sumplevin used a variable which they call a monodromy matrix, which is not what everybody else in the world calls a monodromy matrix, but it is, in fact, a monodromy matrix of sorts. But I will call it the deformed conformal metric because it's just that. It is essentially like the conformal metric, but it's a deformation. It is an a nonlinear integral transform of the non-deformed conformal metric. If you want the deformed conformal metric at a point P, here's the symmetry reduced spacetime. We've factored out the cylindrical symmetry orbits. So we just have a two-dimensional spacetime with a line here, which is a world sheet of the symmetry axis. And here is our left branch, the branch that touches the symmetry axis. In principle, we would have the other branch, but we're not going to do anything with the other branch in this talk. Okay, so if you want the deformed conformal two metric here, then you have to make a nonlinear integral transform of the conformal two metric on this interval from the axis to the point P on N. Okay, and this new datum captures all the information that's in the conformal two metric that actually propagates off the initial surface. It propagates everything except these captures everything except these shockwave modes. So that's quite nice, and it has a property, which we will use a little further on. That is that on solutions to the space-time field equations, the deformed conformal two metric at this point on the initial data surface is equal to the unconformed conformal two metric at this point on the axis that's reached from P by a path-directed light ray. Okay, so we said about Andreas Fuchs, who was my student, and I said about calculating the Poisson brackets of these deformed conformal two metrics, starting from the Poisson brackets of the null data, and we arrive at this result.
Spectral parameter?
It is. Right, exactly. And we were very happy because we found exactly the Poisson bracket that Korotkin and Samtleben had for these variables, which they, of course, started from another starting point. So that sort of confirmed that the whole scheme was sound. And this is what they quantized, so great. So we have something that we can that has been quantized. Here, let me explain a little bit. PV 1 over x is the Cauchy principal value distribution of 1 over x. W is is one of several things called a spectral parameter. Here is the only thing I will call a spectral parameter in this talk. On this hypersurface NL, or line in the reduced spacetime, it can be identified with twice the area density to rho or with minus 2 rho tilde, where rho tilde is a time coordinate so that the line element on the reduced spacetime is proportional to the Minkowski metric with rho tilde as the time and rho as the space coordinate. Okay. So that's a little description of that. This can be rewritten somewhat more abstractly in this following way. I don't know if you're familiar with this notation. Here I had epsilon AB and epsilon CD. So this is obviously, there's no contraction here. So you could say that this is in one space and this is in another space. Well, here I simply put a number over each variable that saying that which space it is in. So I have two copies of the space, the vector space on which this acts, and this acts in the first copy, this in the second copy. In this way, I can write without writing indices, but also not confusing tensor contractions with tensor products. Okay, this is a standard notation. And omega one here is a tensor in the product of the two spaces, which is called the Casimir tensor, the inverse of the Killing form. Okay, so algebraic structures we were. So let's look into algebraic structures that involve just epsilon, the deformed conformal metric for now. the Gerov group acts cylindrically symmetrical gravity has a symmetry group called the Gerov group, which maps solutions to solutions. It acts on this variable, on this datum epsilon, in this way. It just, you multiply by G, which is also a function of the spectral parameter, and the transpose of G on the other side. G is an SL2R valued function of W. So modulo what functions you allow, this is the loop, this is an element of the loop group LSL2R. Okay. And the action of this Gerov group is clearly transitive in the space of epsilon fields. The epsilon fields, if you go back to the definition, you can see that they're real, symmetric, positive, definite, and have determinant 1. Those are all properties of just the non-deformed conformal 2 metric. So if they're equal, the deformed one has to have them also. Oh. Okay, here we are. Okay.
Sorry, is this omega a parameter along this axis? You were saying big E is a small e somewhere in the previous slide.
Yeah.
Just figure.
Which one? This here.
Sorry, you say big E is the metric at that point. So what is the meaning? Is the spectral parameter?
Yeah.
Of the position?
So I.
Or it's not.
You can work with just functions of rho or rho tilde, or you can work with the spectral parameter. But for functions on the initial data surface, the spectral parameter can be identified either with 2 rho or minus 2 rho tilde. I changed to the spectral parameter, but I could have continued with preferred to change.
So the rho at which point?
At the point at which the field lives. I know, now let me not get sidetracked. Okay, so you could ask, so you have a Poisson bracket and you have the symmetry action. So is this action, is the Poisson bracket invariant under the symmetry action? Is the Gerov transformation a symplectic transformation? And no, it's not. Well, it's certainly not a symplectic transformation, but it can be symmetric under this transformation if the group of transformations itself carries a non-trivial Poisson bracket. Then if that's the case, then you think of G times F as a phase space of a composite system. And then you can have this relation, which looks rather like, I don't know, it looks like Hindic inscriptions. I quite like it. I think I should put another T here to make it more symmetric, but it's not actually what I wanted to say, so I can't do that. Okay, so this is a transformed E1, a transformed E2. And this is the bracket between these two, which these are obviously functions of both factors in this composite phase space. Okay, it's evaluated at a certain group element of G and at a certain point in the space F of epsilons. Okay, and that can be equal to epsilon, the bracket of epsilon 1, epsilon 2, the one we already saw, at the point gamma x. Gamma x is the point in the space F of epsilons that's reached if you act with the group element gamma on x.
G is what? SL2R or epsilon is the group?
Hmm?
What is the group G?
G is the LSL2R, the Gerov group. Okay. But this is if and only if the bracket on the Gerov group itself is the following bracket, okay, which is called the Sklianin bracket, because it's a well-known Poisson bracket. So it says that the Poisson bracket of G1, G2, is this principal value of 1 over W1 minus W2 times a commutator of the Casimir element with the product of G1 with G2. And it can also be written as the commutator of the product of G1, G2 with either of two matrices or tensors R, R plus or R minus, doesn't matter which you use. Okay, these are called classical R matrices. Okay, and here is the definition that for this particular system. And they satisfy a series of properties. The guarantee, first of all, that the Poisson bracket actually is symmetric, and the classical Yang-Baxter equation guarantees that it satisfies the Jacobi relation. Okay, so this is great because this is a very, for people in integral systems theory, this is an extremely well-known structure. So we have found a well-known structure in this somewhat daunting Poisson algebra.
Question?
Yeah?
Is there some independent physical reason to extend the phase space like that? Or is it just because then you can do stuff?
You mean to a product?
Yeah, I mean for that.
Well, physical, I don't know. First of all, I should say, at this point, I'm happy to find any pattern. I'm just looking for patterns. Physical is a good question. What it means is that when you quantize a system where the symmetry group has a non-trivial Poisson bracket, of course, the symmetry group itself becomes quantized. So the matrix elements of the representation matrices, if you like, of the symmetry group are quantum operators. So it's a quantum group. But that's not really a physical answer, but I don't. Okay, so.
Maybe following briefly up on this question, is then the dynamics, are these additional fields then just spectators?
Of which additional fields?
No, G, the symmetry transfer.
Well, let me go on. I think I will answer your question. Okay, so since the Gerhoff group acts transitively on the space F of epsilons, F ought to be contained in G somehow. There ought to be an image of the deformed conformal matrix in G. So the most obvious way would be, well, any epsilon can be gotten from just the identity by acting with some suitable Gerhoff group element. So you just get G by G transpose. And at least for me, that didn't give anything useful. But there's another way called the classical double. Okay? The Sklenin bracket defines a natural Lie bracket on the dual of the Lie algebra of this Gerhoff group. Okay? So you have the Lie algebra, and you take the dual vector space, which a priori doesn't have any Lie bracket on it, but the Sklenin bracket, the Poisson bracket on the group, gives you a Lie bracket on that dual space. And then you can take this, you've turned L star, the dual, into a Lie algebra of its own, and you can exponentiate that and create a dual group. Okay. And you can also, with this dual group, you can do sort of the inverse job and say, well, the Lie bracket on my original Lie algebra of the Gerhoff group will define a Poisson bracket on this dual group, which is called the Semenov-Tianshansky bracket. These things have names because they occur often. Okay, and G times G star, the group times the dual group forms what's called a classical double. And what I will say is that F, the space of epsilons, is more or less G star. Okay. I should say also notice that the Killing form identifies the dual Lie algebra with the Lie algebra, and also as vector spaces, and G star with G as a manifold. So it's a group which has the same elements but a different multiplication law. Okay. So let me explain all of this in a little bit more detail. It's still just an outline, but okay. So the Killing form, the classical R matrices are tensors with two downstairs indices, so they map the Lie algebra to the dual Lie algebra, but we can use the Killing form to turn it into a map of the Lie algebra to itself. And we call those capital R plus minus, and from one of the relations that the classical R matrices satisfy, we see that the difference of R minus is a multiple of the identity. So we can define a decomposition of any Lie algebra element by acting with R plus or R minus on A into an A plus and an A minus. And well, doing some more work, you find that these two sets of the Lie algebra, they commute under the Lie bracket of the dual that came from the Sclennan bracket, okay. And we can also, integrating them up, we get two subgroups of G, and we can define a factorization of the Gerhoff group into a product of factors that are in the one subgroup, G minus, and the factor in the other subgroup, G plus. And we can write any element as G minus inverse times G plus. Okay, so corresponding to this decomposition of the Lie algebra, we can also get a factorization of the Lie group. And we can define, so G star, we can state explicitly what the multiplication law is. If you multiply the elements of the group instead of using the ordinary multiplication of the original Gerhoff group, use the dual one, it's simply G star H is H minus inverse times G minus inverse times G plus times H plus. It's a sort of a normal ordered product where all the pluses go on one side and all the minuses go on the other side. Okay, in the case of our problem, with our R matrices, this decomposition is a decomposition into positive and negative frequency in W. And I said that W could be identified with a time, so you can think of it as a real positive negative energy decomposition. Okay, so I've told you a little bit more about the structure of this dual group, or the dual multiplication law. And now I'm going to show you how you can define an object within this structure, within this dual group, which has all the properties of the deformed conformal metric. Because the game was that we wanted to find an image of our phase space in this group somehow. OK, so the object is, I call it A, is G plus times the anti-symmetric 2x2 tensor. Metric times G minus transpose. Okay. Okay, so in order that it has the properties of the deformed conformal metric, you have to define a real section. You have to go to a complexification of G star and then define a new real section, which is not the old real section. We require that G minus is the complex conjugate of G plus times the anti-symmetric matrix, the symbol. We also require that this object here, A, is real, or we could require that it's symmetric. It comes to the same thing, because the first condition guarantees that it's self-adjoint. Well, with these two requirements imposed, then A is real symmetric positive definite and of determinant 1. So these A's fill up the space of possible deformed conformal metrics. But that, the good part is that the Semenov-Tyanshansky bracket, which is the natural Poisson bracket on this G star, implies that A satisfies the same bracket as epsilon. Hello? Ah. Okay, so this is great. Korotkin and Samtleben obtained essentially this structure in a different way back in 98. So, but already there's a lot of structure and a lot of familiar structures. Not really familiar to me until I started with this, but very familiar to the Leningrad school and to everybody else who works in integrable systems. Okay, so, but we only have this datum epsilon, and there were two other data. There are just two more numbers, lambda and rho zero, and it would be great to include them. It would be great to include them because eventually you have to include them, but it would also be great to include them because when you have rho zero, if you could quantize epsilon and rho zero and lambda, then you would have a quantum operator for the area of S zero. And then you could ask things like, does the holographic entropy bound work in a given quantization? You can't really, since the holographic entropy bound gives you a relation between the area of such a null sheet in the Busse's formulation and, well, the entropy, which you could hope is the same as the dimension of the, or the log of the dimension of the Hilbert space, then you can ask if that's true in a given quantization, but for that you have to quantize those zero. Okay, so can these be put into the structure somehow? Well, the SL2R loop has a natural extension by precisely 2 degrees of freedom to the simplest affine Lie group, which is an exponentiation of the Kac-Moody algebra A11. Well, it's the simplest Kac-Moody algebra. And this extension consists of, well, it consists of LSL2R and a central factor, exponential coefficient A, which is the degree of freedom, and K, which is the central generator, and a translation operator, which again is a factor B, exponential of a factor B, which is the degree of freedom I'm talking about, times the derivative in W. So it's a translation operator in W. Can A and B be identified with lambda and rho zero? How am I doing for time?
10 more minutes.
Okay, well, so I'll probably finish early then. Well, maybe not, we'll see. Okay, so to look into this, we should really work out the Poisson algebra of epsilon, lambda, and rho zero. I gave you the Poisson algebra of mu, mu bar, lambda, and rho zero. And then I gave you the Poisson algebra, the brackets of epsilon with itself. But I should also calculate the brackets of epsilon with the other data. And there we have a surprise. When you calculate it, actually it turns out to be very simple. Here's the bracket of the epsilon 1, epsilon 2 with itself, which is the most complicated part. This is you have already seen. And then you find that the epsilon with rho 0 has bracket 0. That's no surprise because in the original algebra, mu and mu bar had bracket 0 with rho 0, so it's impossible that it would have a non-zero bracket with epsilon. But here, the surprise is that epsilon has bracket 0 with lambda. And then lambda and rho 0 have just this canonical bracket. Okay, so let me first say, this is a result of a calculation, but there's a way, quite easy way to see that it ought to be this way. Because epsilon, the deformed conformal metric at P, is equal to the undeformed metric at this point PAX. Okay, lambda lives at S0. That means lambda is a function of the metric at S0, space-time metric. And epsilon, E, the undeformed conformal metric, is a function of space-time metric at this point PAX at the on the axis. These two points are space-like separated. So they should the data there, or the fields there, should have bracket zero. And they do.
Sorry, can you remind us what lambda is?
Lambda is you take the
redshift.
Yeah, you take the inner product of the tangents in your favorite in the parameterization of the generators at S zero. And you take the logarithm. Okay, so we have two commuting subalgebras which we know more or less how to quantize. Korotkin and Samtleben told us how to quantize this, and our first quantum mechanics professor told us how to quantize this. Okay, so maybe we should really stop here because, you know, there's no problem anymore. But let's press on and see if the original idea of lambda and rho zero fitting naturally into the classical double of the extended loop group also works. The one reason is that this actually only works when the point P at which we're taking epsilon is on the left branch minus S0. As soon as you go to S0, then it doesn't work. It's not so simple anymore. And not to mention when you go to the other branch. So since this seems somehow almost a lucky accident, although of course it has its logical reason, and this seems rather a natural idea, it's good to have it as a possibility. Okay, so instead of using the deformed conformal metric at a given value of rho, on the left branch, let's work with the deformed conformal metric at a, let's say, you could say a given distance from the intersection two surface, S0. So at a given value of delta is equal to rho minus rho zero. Okay, so if we take this new function, which is epsilon at a given value of this delta, then and call that epsilon prime. That's not the derivative, it's just a new epsilon. Then epsilon delta is equal to epsilon delta, epsilon prime delta is equal to epsilon delta plus rho zero. And then the Poisson bracket of lambda with epsilon prime is not zero, it's minus 8 pi g derivative in rho of epsilon prime, which is minus 16 pi g prime derivative in spectral parameter. Okay, so if you do that, then you can cook up this object, which is consists of a shift operator, the element epsilon prime tensor, and the central factor, and it satisfies which. Well, so it incorporates rho zero, lambda, and epsilon, and it satisfies a compact commutation Poisson bracket relation, which is given here, which is rather similar to the Poisson bracket relation just for just epsilon. And this Poisson bracket is also invariant on the action of the extended Gerhoff group, where the extended Gerhoff group is the extension of the SL2R loop group that I mentioned to you. So it has a shift operator and a central factor beside the loop factor. Okay, and so this is invariant under these transformations, this Poisson bracket, again, if G tilde, this extended Gerhoff group has a Poisson bracket on it, which is again a Sklyanin bracket. Okay, so it works out quite similarly to the case of just the epsilon without the lambda and rho zero incorporated, which is very nice. Of course, as long as you just have this algebra that I showed you on n left minus s zero, then it's nice, but a very complicated way of representing a very simple algebra. But as I said, when you want to go beyond this restricted domain and try to deal with all of the initial data surface, then it might be valuable to have this because it's, in a sense, a natural structure. Okay, and I also want to comment, so this is, I'm getting to the very end here, the quantization of classical double extended in this way has been studied. This is a paper by Reshetykin and Semenov-Ganshansky from 89. And we're studying what they found. Okay, so that's it.
Mm-hmm. And now you're working just sort of one matrix, is that right?
Right.
So quantizing the area would...
Right, so... Well, I mean, you can define the area. And it would actually be an area in cylindrically symmetrical gravity. Multiply rho by the coordinate area of S0 in the theta coordinates, which the theta coordinates, when you go down to cylindrically symmetrical gravity, have to be adapted to cylindrical symmetry. So it's so that defines an area. But of course, the interesting situation is when you pull it back to, that's the idea, pull it back to the symmetry-less case, full four-dimensional case. But there's some steps missing before we get to that. Well, so you can quantize it very nicely with a sort of a loop quantization. In fact, if you want something like the Busso bound to hold, you need the area to have a discrete spectrum. Otherwise, you won't have finite dimensional eigen subspaces. I mean, if this interpretation of the Busso bound, where it's just the dimension of the, yeah.
In this
structure, there's nothing. You just have two commuting Poisson algebras. You can quantize them any way you like, each one. So there's nothing there. So that's, in a sense, would be a little bit bad news. Whether in these classical doubles there is more structure to these extended that was part of the hope in doing this that this algebraic building it up as from the extended loop group, I was hoping that this would force a discrete spectrum or any specific spectrum. Let's see, so many people have put up their hands. Yeah. Okay, Wolfgang.
Maybe maybe going into a different direction. So in your quantization scheme, do you also have representations of observables like mass, angular momentum, or other charges?
You mean quasi-local charges?
For instance.
Well, this is an interesting question, which does go in another direction, but I have a paper coming out it's not about that, so maybe I shouldn't say it, but it's closer to that than this. When you calculate the Poisson brackets, you go to a lot of trouble to get rid of certain surface terms or to somehow sidestep them. But these surface terms I'm almost certain are quasi-local mass, angular momentum, etc. generators. So I think out of this formalism at the classical level, I think those generators would emerge very naturally.
Or,
as far as the quantization, no, I don't know anything.
Or put differently, because as far as I understand, the phase space is associated to the entire Nari surface.
Yes.
So do you expect that you get that the charges are rather more like flux integrals over this entire Nari surface, rather than charges which are more like integrals over cross sections?
The charges I'm talking about are basically come from boundary terms in the symplectic two form. And so those would be boundary terms in the symplectic two form when one of the variations is a diffeomorphism. So there you get these boundary terms, which I think must be quasi-local Hamiltonian momentum. So those would certainly be surface. Lee?
There's a famous, I don't remember the name, but there are a lot of mathematicians. A famous isomorphism between the representations of the loop group, the central extension, and the representations of the quantum group same group. So if you start with SL2 and make a loop group, make central extension, or start with SL2 and make the quantum group, the root of unity, there's a theorem that tells you there's an isomorphism between those representations. Is that something that you, so there's a two-part question. One, is that something you can use? And two, would you find, because of that, a role in the cosmological constant as playing a role in a central extension, the way that in the quantum gravity, the cosmological constant plays a role in the quantum extension of the root of unity?
Well, okay, so thanks for telling me about this, because I didn't know. But I can't answer your second question because I don't know. But it's interesting. Yeah, so I should say that at present, Korotkin and Samtleben's quantization doesn't have a representation. I mean, it hasn't been shown that the representation they proposed, or any other, respects the reality conditions on the data. So certainly it would be, maybe this would be useful. So I've been speaking a little bit to Korotkin, who I'm going to visit next week. And so we're going to think about maybe how either to prove that their representation really is good, or find another one. Maybe that's an interesting hint.
Does anything interesting happen in your formulation when you turn on a cosmological constant, either positive or negative?
I don't know. I've been working strictly in vacuum gravity, so with zero cosmological constant. Perhaps there would be.
Yeah, you referred to the Boussard bound, but maybe I'm misremembering it, but I thought it involves an entropy flux across. So where?
Yeah. So sorry. Maybe I let you finish the question.
Yeah. Where is the?
Okay. So no, I'm really saying and talking about an extrapolation that I made, and I suppose probably many people, of what the Boussard bound might mean, because the entropy flux, at least in the older versions, was a very ad hoc thing. It's sort of a semi-classical thing but the bound itself seems like it should be something deep. So one thing you could think is that, well, the entropy ought to be the logarithm of the dimension of the Hilbert space, of the subspace, of the eigen subspace corresponding to the area you put. So you have an area operator. This divides the total Hilbert space into some eigen subspaces. And then...
Speed spectrum.
And right, and the entropy would be the logarithm of the dimensionality of this eigen subspace, and then the bound would say that, well, these eigen subspaces have a dimension less than the exponential of area over 4.
I don't know. So this is. This is a different bound, is that right?
It's an extrapolation of.
Well, it sounds like you just have one cross section. I mean, in that bound, one had two cross sections, compared the areas of the two cross sections.
Well, the original Busso bound had just one cross section. Then he realized that he could cut it off, and that the entropy was bounded by the difference in the areas, like that. But
in the areas between?
Between the bigger cross-section and the smaller one.
So that's two cross-sections.
Right, but there's just a version where you just leave off the smaller cross-section.
Oh. So
that would be a looser bound.
I mean, because the smaller one can't go below 0, is that the idea?
Right, because if A minus some non-zero thing is greater than something, then A will be a fortiori greater than that.
So the this
bound be true? I mean, would you conjecture? I mean, you didn't sort of tell us the quantization. I guess you don't know fully the quantization.
I, at the level I'm at, is trying to find patterns in the Poisson, classical Poisson algebra.
One might imagine this depends on your choice of ground state or your choice of state, let's say.
Whether the Busso bound holds.
Yeah.
Sure. But so there are two things you can do. You can either hope that you're going to quantize and then say and find a theorem that the Busso bound has to hold, or you could hope that you're quantizing in this whole forest of possible quantizations, but there's a subclass or only one that satisfies the Busso bound, and you have semi-classical arguments for thinking the Busso bound holds, so that must be the good quantization. Sure.
You wrote on this canonical bracket between lambda and rho naught, but rho naught's supposed to be positive, right? So what that isn't that just immediately a problem for quantization? I mean, you know what that quantization is, and rho has to have.
That's true. You're right.
Real line. If you can put a boundary condition, then lambda is not a self-adjoint operator. So it's a.
Right. So you could.
You have to do something different.
Right. So you could quantize a rho that's not positive, and then say that your rho that corresponds to the classical thing is, I don't know, is the absolute value. I don't know. He was saying that the question was that I have these canonical commutation relations, but actually one of the variables naturally lives just in the positive reals.
But why can't you just solve this by choosing appropriate boundary conditions?
Because there aren't appropriate boundary conditions that make lambda self-adjoint operator. Unless you do something
or you
like
do
unless
you're going to
yeah I.
I mean, as far as I know, the only thing you can do is compactify the thing, possibly with a phase. So it takes a maximal value of rho and say that's identical to rho plus zero.
Something like that. Well, I'm not very prepared to answer this right now. But I did work out a sort of a loop quantization of this. So you don't quantize lambda; you quantize the exponential of I times some factor times lambda. And I think it was okay. But I don't remember why it was okay.
Can you remind, what is it? Is this positivity the positivity of square root of minus g, basically?
Yeah.
That's the same.
Yeah.
Same thing. Yeah, I think Chris Aisha thought about that at some point and proposed something, but.
Or you just take into account different orientations.
You allow.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, you could say that negative rho is reversed orientation. Yeah, I don't know. You had a question? Do you still have it? Yeah.
It's a technical question. When you go to the, so I assume that the initial extension you showed us to the loop group was a Poisson-Lee group.
Yeah.
And then when you go to the extension, the central extension, is that still a Poisson-Lee group or is it quasi? Do you know? Is Jacobi satisfied?
I think so, yeah. Yeah.
So there's no quasi structure anywhere here.
I don't think so, no.
What's your quasi?
It's the only group where Jacobi fails, but in a very particular case.
Yeah. No, the Young-Baxter, classical Young-Baxter satisfied. Well.
Right, thank you, Michael.